Good evening, everyone. I'm Joseph Cotto, and before I say another word, Cotto Gottfried is sponsored by Alaska Chaga. To see why their chaga may be a great fit for you, please click on the link below. The show gets 10% of any purchase you make. In times like these, it is important to support businesses that are willing to support shows like this. So what are you waiting for? Check out Alaska Chaga. Also, do you want to understand the world around you and maybe even yourself a bit better than you do now? Are you looking for answers to some of life's greatest questions, even if they are the most difficult ones? Maybe you just want to learn something new. In any case, online great books may be just what you are looking for. When you sign up for a course there by following the link below, Cotto Gottfried gets $45. Learn about the past, insight on our present, and the future by learning in online great books. Knowledge is power. Joining me tonight is someone with one hell of a lot of knowledge, the one, the only, Keith Preston, who has been called by a member of the Cotto Gottfried channel, the quote, I think, quote unquote, Snake Plissken of academics. So hard to imagine a higher compliment than that. Keith, how's it going?
I'm good. What was I called?
The Snake Plissken of academia, okay. Or Snake Plissken of academics. So I think that's about as cool as it gets.
Okay. I'm not sure what that means, but don't.
Now, did you ever see Escape from New York?
I never did. No, I do remember when that was a popular movie, but I don't believe I ever saw that. No.
Snake Plissken is the title character in that film, and he's thought to be one of the coolest characters in American film history. And he has to save the president from New York, from Manhattan, which has become an island prison. So it is the determination of one member of the Cotto Gottfried channel that you are the Snake Plissken of academics. So quite a compliment indeed.
Yes.
Okay, so tonight we're going to be discussing, though, not Escape from New York, which is a great film, though. If you haven't seen it, I highly recommend that folks check it out. We're going to be discussing the lack of legitimacy that many people see, many Americans see, in their government. It's not just on the right, it's on the left. And I will say that if you have a reasonable and responsible question for Keith or myself, please do leave it in the live chat, the super chat, and we'll get to it. But don't leave it all for the end. Thank you very much for that in advance. So I guess I'll just start off with a sort of premise of the conversation. Over the last few years, a lot of people on the left have thought that Donald Trump is a Russian agent. Russia hacked the election. Russia somehow interfered with the 2016 election. And therefore, the results of it have to be considered suspect, inaccurate, blah, blah, blah. And a lot of folks have been seriously considering America's system of government to be illegitimate. Once again, anti-Trump people were mostly on the left because they view it as being unduly interfered with by the Russians. Now, with the 2020 election, a lot of people on the right, Trump supporters, say that the American governing system is illegitimate because it allows for such a large degree of voter fraud, specifically in key states, and that's something which Trump is still fighting in court as well as in various state legislatures. So you have both sides of the aisle now sort of seeing the American system as illegitimate. And that to me is fascinating. It's not something I think most people would have imagined possible just a few years ago, but that is the way it is today. So I guess, Keith, since you are, of course, not just an academic, but an anarchist, any thoughts on this really interesting turn of events and what it might mean for American politics, maybe just American society going forward?
Well, this is a continuation of a trend that I started to notice a few years ago. Even before Donald Trump was elected, I started to notice at one point, probably in the early 2010s, that increasingly the two sides in U.S. politics simply viewed each other as illegitimate. That the we have the two leading coalitions, the red team and the blue team, or the red tribe and the blue tribe, as I call them, the Democrats and Republicans. I do think that political conflict and division in the U.S. is far more complicated than just the two-party differences. But that's how it tends to break down on the most immediately obvious level. And I started to notice that increasingly the red team and the blue team viewed each other as by nature illegitimate when they win elections. And that seems to have escalated dramatically with Donald Trump. And now with Joe Biden's election, for the reasons you've explained. And I've noticed increasingly that the two sides view each other as existential enemies. They don't see each other merely as competitors or people they disagree with or anything like that, but rather they're the equivalent of enemy nations with whom they're at war. In fact, I've mentioned this to people who are partisans on both sides of that divide, people who were gung-ho Fox News watchers and Donald Trump voters and people who are gung-ho liberals or leftists and who feel that Donald Trump was a fascist. And I've mentioned this concept to people from both sides, and they say, yeah, that's how I view it. You know, the other side is the enemy, period. The other side wants to do this or that to us or destroy our way of life or do awful things from their perception. So I do see both of these things happening. The two sides increasingly view each other as existential enemies. And when that happens, that impacts the ability of a democratically elected government to function, because for any kind of democracy, however it's structured to function, the different contenders have to view a victory by their opponents as legitimate, at least on some level. You have to have accepted rules of the game in order to play the game in the first place. And in order for the game to work, you have to be willing to lose gracefully with the expectation that you'll get another chance somewhere down the line. And you know, that's how everything works. That's how sports work. I mean, baseball couldn't work if the Yankees and Red Sox didn't even agree on what the rules of baseball are. Or if they thought that the other team winning a game meant not just losing a game, but meant their death and destruction or something like that. And increasingly, that's how the different political factions seem to be viewing each other. And we've seen this plenty of times in other nations where you see the electoral parties or components of a country that's ostensibly democratic falling in this kind of situation where they regard each other as existential enemies. The famous case, obviously, the most famous case was the Weimar Republic, the government of Germany between the two world wars, which was a parliamentary democracy. It was the first time that Germany had ever had a full-fledged parliamentary democracy. And for a wide range of reasons, it came to be viewed as illegitimate, in part because the Germans were not accustomed to that system of government. They were traditionally a monarchy, also because of the impact of the First World War and also because of the Great Depression and a number of other things. So increasingly, what you had in Weimar was the two largest parties became the parties that were committed to the overthrow of the Republic, the Nazi Party and the Communists. And there are certainly prototypes of this and other, or precedents for this in other countries. And in Algeria in the early 90s, there was an election where one of the parties was an Islamist party. And their platform was, if we're elected, we're going to do away with this democracy thing and set up an Islamic state. And they won. And then the military of Algeria stepped in and said, well, no, we're not going to recognize this. So they stepped in and nullified the results of the election. Similar things have happened in Turkey. In Turkey, what's interesting about Turkey is that the secular forces have largely been what Americans call the deep state, that is the intelligence services and the military. Whereas on a more popular level, there's always been strong support for Islamism. And that's still an issue there. Erdogan, to a large degree, appeals to Islamists in Turkey, and then he's been constantly at war with the deep state in Turkey over some of that. And we could cite many other examples, but the common denominator in all of this is that you do find plenty of examples from all over the world of democratic countries that have fallen apart or barely cohere. Because of the fact that the different sides simply view each other as illegitimate. Statistically, about 1 in 5 elections worldwide is associated with violence. That is, there's not just people voting, there's people fighting and or shooting or bombing or doing whatever they're going to do. You can just go on YouTube or do a Google search and find all kinds of examples. Just Google violence elections, and you can see that there was a massacre associated with this election somewhere in Kenya at one point, or somewhere in one of the South Asian countries. And so that's far more common than what Americans are likely to realize. And I do see the United States going increasingly in a direction where maintaining a stable democratically elected government, even one as flawed as our own, is going to be increasingly difficult.
And how far down the road do you see the United States right now?
Well, it seems to be escalating fairly rapidly. This wider red team, blue team divide has certainly been present for a long time. I remember how it was back in 2000 when the 2000 presidential election between George W. Bush and Al Gore was contested in the way that it was. And I thought that was a pretty divisive moment. But now that seems fairly trivial compared to what's happened in more recent years. And I think that in particular, I would say in the last 10 years or so, starting probably around the time of Obama's second term and then on into the Trump era, I've noticed this expanding very rapidly. And I think there's a number of things that are driving it. I think one of it is very rapid cultural and demographic change. There are a lot of people on the right and some on the left have pointed out that we see the ethnic demography of the United States changing very rapidly. And I think that we're starting to see the impact of that in electoral politics. Also very rapid cultural change it has happened in recent years. I remember, for example, when gay marriage wasn't even on the radar. I mean, much less something like transgender rights or, you know, I mean, the more diverse the wider society becomes, the more change you see in society. I think the more conflict there is. And I think socioeconomic conflict really drives this. That's one thing that is left out of the mainstream media narratives, because I've noticed that the whether it's Fox and the Republicans or whether it's MSNBC and CNN and the which are more democratic leaning, and certainly the centrist, the traditional centrist media like ABC and all of that, they very rarely talk about socioeconomic issues, and there's obvious reasons why they don't do that. But I do think that the class divisions that we see happening in the United States are becoming a major driving force as well. The reason that Donald Trump won the election in 2016 was because he ran as the anti-globalization candidate, and that allowed him to flip the Rust Belt in his favor. And the reason that he lost this time around was because he did not manage to keep the Rust Belt. He lost some of the Rust Belt states that he won last time. And I think the reason for that was he was viewed as being ineffective at successfully fighting globalization and its domestic economic impact. I've seen a lot of pundits and commentators try to come up with every possible explanation as to why Donald Trump won in 2016 and then lost this time around, and some of which are a reach. Of course, the most obvious one is the one that comes from the left, where they say, well, there's all of this latent racism in the United States and Donald Trump has brought it to the surface, which I would say no. I mean, people who have conservative or further right views on race typically vote Republican anyway, if they vote at all. But I don't think that's what Donald Trump got elected president on. He got elected president as essentially the anti-globalization candidate because of the impact that that's had on the Rust Belt states in terms of manufacturing and unemployment and living conditions. And he hasn't been able to hold on to that constituency.
And I guess looking at what's going on now with the contest over the election, presuming that, say, like this will do both scenarios, we'll say, say Trump is not able to score a victory in the Electoral College somehow, whether it's through, the courts or through state legislatures, it seems like there's going to be a large majority of Republicans going forward just look at the system as being illegitimate. What sort of impact would you expect that to have on the politics of the Republican Party specifically?
Well, on the Republican Party, first of all, I don't think Trump is going to be able to overturn the election. I don't see any real evidence that that's going to happen. So I think Biden is going to be the next president. And now what's going to be interesting is whether or not Biden actually finishes his term. I think that's a whole other issue. But I have seen in recent days since the election, or recent weeks since the election, it seems that now the Republican Party is really fragmenting. I've noticed that Fox News, a lot of the elements on Fox News just couldn't wait to throw Trump under the bus once it was indicated that he was a probable loser of the election. I've seen a big split now taking place between Trumpists on one hand and Fox News on the other. And of course, there's this talk that Trump may actually start his own network or something like that, Trump TV, or that he'll simply go to one of these further right networks, Newsmax, or what's the one, the
OANN, yep.
If he does that, if Trump decides that he's going to throw his weight behind one of those networks, then he will essentially have destroyed Fox. He's going to take half of Fox's audience with him. So you're going to see the Republican constituency split right down the middle between the Trumpists with this kind of populist nationalist outlook on one hand, and the traditional Republicans, or at this point are basically just neocons, on the other hand. So you're going to see an even bigger split among the Republicans than what we've seen in the Trump era so far. I don't think that that is going to bode well for the future of the Republican Party. One thing that was interesting, though, about the Republicans in this election is that they actually did better among virtually all demographics than they did in 2016. The interesting exception was white males without a college education. They actually did worse among the lesser educated white males who were supposedly, you know, according to the media, supposed to be the main constituency for the Trumpist movement. I think the reason Trump did worse among that constituency was what I said earlier, because he didn't hold on to the Rust Belt states the way that he did in 2016. But it's interesting, though, that more and more people from the different minority communities, more women, more college-educated people, actually voted for Trump in this election. I've seen some of the people from the left try to explain that, you know, saying, well, what's going on with that? You know, why is our society so dysfunctional that even people of color are voting for a fascist regime or something like that? You know, I think what it shows is that their theory is just simply wrong. And rather than change the theory, they're trying to, you know, bend reality to fit the theory. But I think that what that does show is that increasingly people in the United States see the establishment as fraudulent. I mean, they look at every institution, and polls show this, by the way. Polls show that virtually every institution in the United States has an increasingly negative rating in terms of overall approval. Congress typically has a single digit approval rating, and the media has a low approval rating. Interestingly, I think the military actually has the highest approval rating. That's one of the few institutions that has a 50+% approval rating. But the military is actually a very diverse institution. It's arguably the most diverse institution in the United States, and most integrated. I'm curious to see what's going to happen with this, because on one hand we see the Republican Party in a way moving leftward, you know, becoming more diverse, and where this kind of neo-isolationist rhetoric is becoming more acceptable, and more populist, you know, economic rhetoric is becoming more acceptable. At the same time, you're going to see this ongoing splinter between these more elite Republicans and the more Trumpist Republicans on the ground level. So it seems to be splitting off in these multiple directions at the same time.
Mm-hmm. You know, and of course, the second scenario is, say Trump is able to overcome the odds and pull out a victory in the Electoral College, or if it's thrown to the U.S. House, that's possible as well. What impact would you expect that to have on the Democratic Party going forward, specifically in terms of how people within that party would view the legitimacy of government?
Oh, they'll go insane. They will view that as a fascist coup. I mean, that will be their, you know, they will see that as the enabling act. They will think that what happened is that Trump simply cheated his way to victory through, you know, manipulating the system, and that ultimately a bunch of handpicked justices on the Supreme Court installed Trump as the fascist dictator. That's the narrative that the left would spin if that happened. I'm very skeptical as to whether that's going to happen, but if that were to happen, yeah, I think that's exactly how it would be viewed. I think probably virtually everyone from the Antifa all the way over to the neocon types, like say David Frum and Bill Kristol and those guys, everyone, that whole spectrum would view this as a de facto fascist coup in the United States. Even though I would actually argue that Trump is probably one of the most liberal presidents the United States has ever
had. I would too.
The only two presidents I can think of that were more liberal would be Obama and maybe Jimmy Carter. I can't think of any others that were, you know, more liberal, all things considered. I mean, maybe on some things, but you know, just in terms of overall approach.
And, you know, before we move on, I suppose, getting back to how people view the legitimacy of government or lack thereof, how is it that you think Trump has been a liberal president? Because some, you know, some would say he's like a right-wing dictator or this or that or the other thing. Of course, you and I disagree profoundly on that. And obviously, I do concur that he has been far more left of center than I think most anyone, even many of his own supporters, would like to admit. So, Akeith, when you say Trump has been a rather liberal president, what specifically would lead you to say that?
Well, number one, he's made anti-interventionist foreign policy rhetoric acceptable among the Republicans and among the Democrats in a way that it hasn't been since for a long time. Mm-hmm. He's challenged this. The rhetoric has to be separated from the actual performance. Mm-hmm. But he's made this kind of neo-isolationist, non-interventionist rhetoric certainly much more acceptable. The last time we had a major party candidate with that kind of viewpoint was probably somebody like George McGovern. Now mm-hmm. Trump isn't as pacifistic as George McGovern, obviously. But for the first time in generations, you have a presidential figure that even hints at ideas like that in a way that I think changes the discourse on a certain level. A lot of Trumpists will say, well, he hasn't started any new wars. And I do think that's true. He hasn't actually committed troops, for example, to any new locations where they weren't already. He's drawn down troops, very lightly in some places. So I think he's been less or certainly no more non-interventionist than any of his predecessors. Also on the economic questions, the fact that he makes labor representative Dick Gephardt, used to be a big proponent of labor protectionism, but that was fairly common at one point when you still had a lot of New Deal Democrats in Congress. But now virtually all Democrats in Congress are neoliberals, except for these ones on the far fringes, like the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and people like that. He's actually made anti-free trade or anti-globalization rhetoric acceptable. In terms of the party demographics, he performed better in this election among blacks than the Republican Party ever has, at least the modern Republican Party. He performed better among college-educated women, among virtually all minority groups, among gays and the LGBT configuration. So the idea that he somehow built this kind of fascist following that wants to exclude all of these traditionally excluded people is silly. He's actually expanded the diversity of his own, of the Republican Party voting base. You've seen at some of his campaign rallies, at least the first time he ran, you would see him with rainbow flags, holding a rainbow flag. I mean, you didn't see George W. Bush doing that. You didn't see Ronald Reagan doing that. You certainly didn't see anyone prior to, say, the 1970s doing anything like that. Even Jimmy Carter never came out and endorsed anything like that. That's another thing. Gave a speech at the Republican convention in 2016. He was talking about how a priority of his administration is to protect the gay community, implying that terrorism against gay, because this was not long after the Pulse nightclub incident. Yep, yep. So he was saying we're protecting the gay community against Islamic terrorism. Also, in terms of his personal life, a guy who has been married 3 times and his wife is a former Playboy model and who owns casinos and strip clubs and things like this. I mean, this guy is not a social conservative I heard a joke one time that said that Trump probably has paid for more abortions than most people have children. And I suspect that's probably the case. He's probably fathered more abortions than he's fathered kids. In fact, I remember some years ago, he gave an interview on the Howard Stern program. I mean, the fact that he was ever on the Howard Stern program shows his liberalism, I suppose. But he gave a Howard Stern interview once some years ago where he said that condomless sex during the AIDS crisis in the 80s was his personal Vietnam, is how he described it. So we're not really talking about a Bible banger or something here. So in his personal life, he's certainly quote unquote liberal. And as I said, his voting base is the most liberal voting base the Republican Party, or the most diverse, demographically diverse voting base the Republican Party has had, certainly in its modern history. And he's made isolationist and anti-globalization rhetoric acceptable as well. Now, of course, in a lot of ways, he's governed like a normal Republican would. I mean, he's been big on tax cuts. You know, he's been big on deregulating industries. He's certainly been very pro-Israel and pro-Saudi Arabia and all of that. But that's not necessarily a left-right issue. Jimmy Carter, for example, deregulated a lot of industries. In fact, he was really the guy who started in the ushered in the neoliberal era. A lot of people associate that with Ronald Reagan, but that really gets started under Jimmy Carter. It's the whole liberal conservative dichotomy is somewhat it's not something where you can really pigeonhole someone into categories. But another thing is this criminal justice reform thing, the First Step Act that Trump signed into law, and the fact that he's given pardons to people, like black people who were serving life sentences for dealing crack or something like that, mm-hmm. those kinds of things. So, I mean, we could go down a long list of things that Trump has done that are, stereotypical liberal policy initiatives. I know even on the environment, he's considered to be horrible on the environment, but there are ways in which he's actually enacted environmental policies to protect overgrowth, wild growth and stuff like that as well. Now he's a climate change denier, so he's unpopular for that reason, but he's not as explicitly anti-environmentalist as he's made out to be either.
Yeah, the whole thing is very interesting. Actual activity in relation to what stereotypes are about Trump's rule, and it's something else to see. His base, obviously, which voted for, by and large, certainly not totality, by and large, voted for conservative candidates in the past, is okay, at least, with all this stuff. A lot of his base is even very strongly supportive of it. So I think it could be fair to say that conservatism, as it traditionally has been articulated as a movement and as a philosophy to the extent it ever was coherent enough to be a philosophy, at least in the United States, it would seem that now is of less and less relevance, to say the least. I was going to say minimal relevance, but that might be an overstatement. Before we move along, Keith, anything to say about my perspective there?
Yeah, I've noticed that what has been considered conservatism in the United States seems to be fading in terms of its influence. You don't find the gung-ho, hawkish foreign policy views being nearly as common anymore. I mean, you do among the neocons and those people, but just on a grassroots level, I don't really hear that many rank-and-file Republican voters or talking about what's really wrong with the world is we don't spend enough money on the military and things like that. Certainly, I think the social conservatives have lost influence. I don't hear much about them anymore. Now the evangelicals have been one of Trump's strongest voting blocks, but they're increasingly a minority within the wider Republican Party base, I think. They're increasingly marginal. And they strike me as people who are clinging desperately because they're like, we don't have anywhere to go. I find it really interesting that so many of them have developed such a worshipful attitude towards Trump. I know some of them. I've said, you do know who this guy is, right? I mean, you do know what his background and personal history is. But it's kind of like, well, what can you do? And so it's desperation. I do think that the anti-immigration movement has gained an influence in a way that it didn't previously have. Although one thing I would say about that is if you look at Trump's actual immigration rhetoric or policies, he's way to the left of Eisenhower. Mm-hmm. If you want to go and look at what a real crackdown on illegal immigration would look like, which was carried out in the 1950s by the Eisenhower administration, which was a massive deportation of illegal immigrants, primarily from Mexico. Millions of people were deported. It was a serious, serious crackdown. But Eisenhower's not considered a fascist or any of that kind of stuff. Trump is way to the left of Eisenhower on immigration, and it's on immigration that Trump's rhetoric, at least, is probably the most conservative, most right-leaning. It seems that a lot, Trump to me has actually moved the Republican Party leftward. In fact, when he was elected, I said that at the time. I said Donald Trump is basically the return of liberal republicanism.
Yeah.
And you know, I was comparing him to Nixon and Nelson Rockefeller and those, you know, liberal Republicans that from the 70s, John Connolly and people like that. And he seems to be more in that vein. You know, he's more of a social liberal than say the Reaganites were. You know, he's more skeptical also, I think, of the neoliberal economic paradigm and perpetual war, you know, so he's not a neocon either. It seemed to me that he actually had the effect of moving the Republican Party leftward. And I think the only reason he's even perceived of as a right winger is because the wider culture has moved much further to the left during the time that Trump has been ascendant. You know, you have a guy that got elected president that would have been considered as, say, an Ed Koch Democrat 30 years ago. And he's now all of a sudden a fascist, you know, because he's not down with transgender people in the military or something like that, which wouldn't even been on the radar, you know, a short time ago. So I think that's the reason for that perception.
It's interesting you bring that up about, you know, Trump being Nixonian or Rockefeller Republican. I myself am a Rockefeller Republican, and I see so many good things in Trump, and you described those things in detail. And if people want to sort of see my perspective and why I support Trump and why I call myself Rockefeller Republican, they somehow think there's some disconnect between the two, but there's really not. If Nelson Rockefeller, who was thought of as, of course, a moderate or liberal Republican for his day, even though there were Republicans well to the left of him at that time, but anyway, if he were around today just doing everything that he did as governor of New York or as vice president, they would call him a fascist too. There's no question about it. He would be, you know, an imperialist, something, you know, because of his family wealth, he'd be thought of as and a member of the oppressor class. And it's exactly as you said, things have just moved so far to the left so quickly that people really don't pick up on the fact that what was a moderate or liberal Republican 40 years ago today is Donald Trump. And people who think that he's some sort of ideological conservative are missing the mark by a mile, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct. Some years ago, Noam Chomsky said that Nixon was the last liberal president. This was before the Trump era. And he was talking about how it was, you know, in the 70s, in the mid to late 70s, during the Ford and Carter years, you start to see the introduction of neoliberalism away from the older New Deal paradigm. And then that really takes off with the Reagan revolution and all of that. And then it was under Bill Clinton, it's really consolidated. Yeah. So Chomsky's point being is that Nixon was actually one of the last presidents who was really within that New Deal paradigm. And same thing with Nixon. If you look at his actual policies, you know, detente with the Soviet Union, the China opening, creating the Environmental Protection Agency, creating OSHA. I mean, these are not far right wing, you know, policies at all. And I think Trump has actually moved in that kind of direction. You know, I think one reason that a lot of the elite hate Trump is that because he offends upper class sensibilities. Mm-hmm. Like I always tell people, from their perspective, he's like the CEO of a company that he shows up at stockholder meetings and picks his nose at the during the meeting or farts or something like that. You know, he's viewed as uncouth and ill-mannered and crude and not a team player and that kind of thing. And I think that's the real objection that a lot of the power elite have to him. And I think at the left, it was what we were talking about earlier. It's, you know, he's viewed as a fascist only because the culture has moved as far left as it has.
Mm-hmm. 110% true. And before we move on, there is something in the live chat for us. I will just reiterate that if you have a reasonable and responsible question for Keith or myself, please leave in the live chat as a super chat, but don't save it all for the end. Thank you very much in advance. From Luke Avedon, who was the one who actually compared you to Steak Plissken? A big compliment from Luke. Proudhon was elected to the Estates General. Why no anarchists in Congress? Will Keith run? I think this is obviously directed at Keith. Keith, anything to say about what Luke brought up?
Yeah, it's interesting because there were actually figures from historic anarchism that did actually end up getting elected at various points to Parliament. Proudhon, who was the first modern figure to call himself an anarchist, was a member of the French Parliament. And in fact, Johann Most, the German anarcho-communist, had actually been in the German Parliament at one point. He, most well known for having written a lot of manuals on how to make bombs and blow things up. So, you certainly have seen that. As a general rule, anarchists tend to be skeptical of electoral politics because they tend to be skeptical of government generally. They tend to think that working in the system is an ineffective means of bringing about whatever kind of change they want to bring about. And that's true of left and right anarchists and libertarians, by the way. You find some anarcho-capitalists and others with similar views that have that kind of outlook. And in fact, whenever a lot of, say, libertarians or anarchists or left anarchists have been involved in electoral politics, it's more intended for educational purposes. It's purely propagandistic. You know, the goal is not to win. The goal is to popularize some particular type of idea, which can be effective. Ron Paul was fairly effective at that from the right libertarian perspective. And you see some of the left libertarian leaning people in the Greens and some other similar groups doing stuff like that as well. And if you find that in a Libertarian Party, Libertarian Party has a left libertarian caucus, the Libertarian Socialist Caucus. And I think there's one of their people was elected to something in one of the northeastern states, New Hampshire. But this person is a transgender Satanist or something like that. I think they were elected sheriff, but it was in one of this. Maybe they weren't elected. Maybe they just ran.
Oh, in New Hampshire, he's a Republican. For sheriff in New Hampshire. Yep.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. You do see that kind of thing occasionally. But as far as me ever running for anything, no.
All right. Let me just see here briefly. I don't see anything else for us right now, so we'll move along. But I will just say, again, if you have a reasonable, responsible question for Keith or myself, please do leave it in the live chat as a super chat. We'll get to it. Just please don't leave it all for the end. Thank you in advance. So, Keith, looking at people viewing the American political system as illegitimate, there is this movement, if you can even call it a movement, but it's a lot of Republicans who are on Parler and some on Twitter saying that they're not going to vote in the Georgia runoff unless they get essentially everything out of Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue, the two Republican senators who are going to go to a senatorial runoff in January. They want them to demand a special session of the state legislature. And there's this fellow who I'm sure you've heard of, Ali Alexander, who's a big, you know, street activist, and he's trying to encourage people, and he's had some success in social media, not to turn out for the runoff unless they that Perdue and Loeffler demand, not only as they have the, what was it that he wanted them? I believe it was to demand for a recount with signature verification of ballots, but also a special session of the legislature. And I believe Ali wanted the special session of the legislature to oversee an audit of votes or something like that. I mean, he said so many different things that is hard to keep up with, but that's the impression I got. And so he did whip up quite a few people. I don't know how legitimate they are to just be leftist Fox, but to come out and say, you know, we're not going to vote because the system's illegitimate, essentially. That's their argument as I perceive it. So, Keith, any take on that and how people, you know, I guess the outcome of people perceiving the system as illegitimate?
Well, I do think that that's interesting. Now, I don't know how large scale a sentiment or a movement that is, but there are, on the left, you find a counterpart to that. You have some people on the left who make the argument that, well, Democrats need, I mean, the left, the progressive left, the socialist leaning left or social democratic leaning left, they will say, well, look, we've got to stop supporting the Democrats no matter what. You know, this vote blue, no matter who, this isn't getting us anywhere because look who they keep putting up, these neoliberals like Biden and Hillary Clinton and all of that. And you did have some people from that side of the spectrum making that kind of argument in this recent election that, no, I'm not going to vote blue no matter who. If the candidate doesn't reflect my values, then I'm not voting for them. Now, that was a minority point of view, I think, among leftists. I think the majority of them were, we got to get rid of Orange Man because he's a fascist or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I do see that happening on the right as well. I do see some Trump people developing exactly the kind of outlook you're talking about. But what's interesting about that, though, is that if Republicans were to boycott the Georgia runoff elections in significant number, that it's quite possible that those two seats in the Senate could go to the Democrats, which means the Democrats would actually control Congress. Which means that the Democrats would have the presidency and both houses of Congress, but what that shows, I think, is that the people who are advocating for this position are saying, well, we're willing to lose to the other side if we can't get what we want on our own side. You know, like we're not going to have this, go along to get along perspective, or this idea of this lesser evilism. We're done with that. We're going to adopt a point of view that we may have to lose some battles in order to win the war. And I do think that that's that movement that you're describing reflects that kind of outlook. And I think that if both sides of the spectrum, like the further right and the further left people, started developing that kind of perspective, I do think it would have a serious impact on electoral politics, because the party leadership, the Republican or Democratic Party leadership, would not be able to take their constituencies for granted in the way that they typically do. The inside joke on the Democratic side, for example, is that, well, the minorities are going to vote for us no matter what. The left is going to vote for us no matter what. So what really matters is we've got to get swing voters and disaffected Republicans and suburbanites who don't like Donald Trump or whatever. And you find some parallels to that on the Republican side as well. Well, we don't need these fever swamp people. We need nice, respectable, middle class suburban people and that kind of thing as our constituents. But I think if the far right and the far left increasingly told their party leadership, no, we're not going to vote for you if you don't do what we want, and even if that means the other side wins, well, we'll just have to lose the battle to win the war, I do think that would force the party leaderships to make more and more concessions to the more marginal sectors, the fringier sectors of their respective parties. For example, if you look at what Joe Biden is doing now, it's clear that he doesn't take the Green New Deal idea seriously. These ideas that the more social democratic elements in the Democratic Party are floating, the Green New Deal, the Medicare for all, cancel college debt or student loan debt, free college, all these kinds of things. There's no evidence that Biden takes any of those ideas seriously or plans to pursue any of that. And the same thing is true on, Republican side. If the Trumpist base were to say, look, either we get our wall or you don't get our votes, period, and made it stick, then yeah, that wall might start showing some more progress as far as being constructed. But the question is going to be, is there going to be enough people on both sides of the spectrum that are, or either one of the spectrums, it could be just one side, that are willing to take that kind of position? Because the kind of position they're going to have to adopt is, we will lose battles in order to win the war in the long term. And when they view each other as existential enemies, that how that affects them psychologically, I think, is interesting. Because if you view your opponents as an existential enemy, do you want to lose a battle in the short term, thinking you're going to win the war in the long term, or vice versa? Is losing any battle, a concession that you don't want to make?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think very many people will take this seriously. I think it's just sort of like people sort of having a temper tantrum or the equivalent of that. But certainly there are folks like that out there, and they seem to not mind losing heavily in the long run. But, I suppose from the right, your perspective would be, not you necessarily, keep us a theoretical person on the right, it would be, well, we could sit this out, but then the Democrats will have control of Congress. Even if Trump wins re-election, they'd have 50 in the U.S. Senate, and that would make it virtually impossible for anything to get done. So what's going to be the outcome of that for us? Obviously nothing good, so we better just suck the vote. On the left, the perspective would be, well, we didn't get everything we wanted with a neoliberal like Biden, but if we don't vote for him, then Trump won re-election. Look what happened last time with Bill Stein. So I think a lot of people say a lot of these, they do a lot of tough talk, big talk in the lead up to these elections. But when the elections themselves actually roll around, you find that most people themselves have rolled over and they've gone to vote for whoever it is that their party's nominated, unhappy as they might be about it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that because the two sides increasingly view each other as existential enemies, they're essentially captives to their own parties. And that, in turn, really, in a way, it has a constraining effect on the ability of the two parties to go in certain directions. I think it may actually have the ironic impact of pushing the electoral system towards the center, because the extremes on each end are captive to their own party, so the parties increasingly don't have to take them, don't have to do anything for them. If people on the left, for example, seriously believe that their choice in an election is either a guy who's Hitler light or somebody who just doesn't want to have Medicare for all, then who are they going to vote for? You know, and the same thing is true on the right. If they think that, well, okay, if the Republican Party leadership doesn't do everything we want to do, even if they don't bend the wall, at least they're not communists, you know, like the Democrats. I think that will probably just continue to perpetrate this ongoing gridlock and the stalemate that we have at present.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree entirely. I don't see that changing at all anywhere down the road, at least within, you know, what I can see. I would, you know, say that the whole system has certain issues, and I don't mean that in a negative sense. I think the Constitution, by and large, was very well written. I certainly don't want to see it reformed or anything like that. I'd be very much opposed to that kind of thing. But I think that a lot of, maybe because courts have traditionally had such a nebulous interpretation of the Constitution, we could have different judges on the same panel saying that a specific, you know, passage from the Constitution means essentially totally different things. I think that probably has contributed to how people now have no real belief in the system. The film Amistad is a pretty interesting example. It's a dramatization, obviously, about how the legal system sort of seesaws. And I think that the seesawing of the American legal system, which has been going on now for generations on end, maybe it's finally snowballed into something, given other, you know, social factors where people are just more polarized partisan now than in the past. But I think if you combine these two things, you might have at least part of the answer as to why people don't look at the government today, regardless of which spectrum they look at it from, as being legitimate in the way that people once did.
Yeah, I do think that's interesting that one thing that we have to consider is that after World War II, you had this whole generation that had come up through World War II where the government is always right. You know, they had this I know a lot of people from, say, my parents' generations, who are now the very elderly generation, that had that kind of outlook. You know, it's like, no matter who, for example, I know when I was a kid, I used to hear it said that no matter who the president is or no matter who the office holder is, you should still respect the office, you know, even if you don't like the man. You never hear that now. I mean, you know, who from, say, the left says, well, you should still respect the office of the presidency, even if you don't like Donald Trump. You know, it's now more a type of tribalism that didn't exist, I think, in some past generations. And I think you're right that the courts have contributed to that, because that's one reason why the two sides are so almost pathologically obsessed with the whole idea of, well, we've got to get our people on the Supreme Court no matter what, you know, because I tend to think that they overemphasize the role of the courts. I look at it like the way that the contentious social issues in the United States are ultimately resolved is based on what is the dominant consensus of the elite, what is the dominant consensus of, say, the educated classes, at least. If you look at how every issue ever has been resolved, that's more or less been the way it's been resolved. It's been, okay, the Supreme Court comes up with some kind of ruling saying, okay, well, this is how it's going to be. And if you look at how their legal reasoning, it just amounts to the, you know, conventional wisdom among the educated classes, I think. Abortion is a perfect example of that. In fact, I remember they handed down a decision on abortion sometime in the 90s. Mm. And it seems that one of the justices actually said that.
Was it Planned Parenthood v. Casey by any chance?
I think that, yeah, that was the one. It was in the early 90s.
Yeah, that was it.
Yeah. And I think it was considered the most important abortion decision since Roe v. Wade. But I believe Justice Souter at the time said, well, we're very concerned about how the educated classes view our decision, or something like that. You know, more or less admitting that's his you know, informal job is to just be an arbiter of disputes that, you know, in the wider society based on the dominant values of the elite. And I think that all all issues ultimately get resolved that way. I haven't seen that many exceptions to that. So I think that the two sides overemphasize the importance of the courts. As far as what really fuels the polarization to the point that the two sides don't view each other as legitimate, or don't view the government as legitimate if the other side is running it, I think that that has to do with conflicting worldviews about a lot of things. There's a lot of different things that feed into that, a lot of different streams that flow into the same ocean. I know I had a student one time, a Jamaican student, tell me that in her country, political conflict is just all about rich and poor. But she's like, you Americans, you fight about everything because you don't agree on anything. And you have such a diverse society that, you know, there's so many things that come up for grabs politically. But you have these different, an analogy I like to make is this. If we look at the conflict between the Sunni and the Shia in the Middle East, to a person who is not a Muslim or from that region, and if they look at that conflict and they say, why are they fighting about that? You know, it's like a Baptist and a Methodist having a war or something. You know, but obviously, though, there are a lot of historical issues and geopolitical issues and economic issues that feed into that, as well as theological differences. And I think the same thing is true among Democrats and Republicans. You have these different narratives that are both rooted, I think, to some degree in American history and culture, but are conflicting in many ways. You have on the right, you have this traditional American civil religion that Robert Bella recognized, this kind of American exceptionalism, and that it has a kind of quasi-religious flavor to it. It's sort of a Judaized, Christianized kind of deism almost. And then for some people, like, for example, the evangelical crowd, they bring that in, they bring the actual Christianity into it. So you've got this, you know, a Christianized Americanism, you know, that like you'll see there in their churches, they'll have the flag right up there with the cross and all that kind of stuff. So you have this kind of American civil religion narrative on one hand, and then you have on the other side, you have this kind of oppression narrative. You know, you have this idea, well, you know, yeah, maybe the founding fathers had some good ideas, you know, but they didn't include black people and women and gays and all these excluded people. So they see the whole of American history as the struggle for equal rights for people that have been excluded from the constitutional system or whatever. Whereas the right wing, they look at it like, well, no, you know, what matters about American history is that, you know, we built a nation out of nothing. You know, we were just a bunch of colonies up and down the Atlantic coast, and now we've got the greatest nation in history and USA. You know, it's you know, why would you criticize that? Yeah, that's awesome. You know, we put a man on the moon. And it's not that either point of view is wrong in a factual sense. It's just it's just a matter of what they choose to emphasize and what they think is most important. And there are wider implicit philosophical differences between the left and the right. I mean, there's, you know, the idea of, you know, constrained and unconstrained visions, like Thomas Sowell has talked about, and, you know, views of human nature. Is human nature malleable or fixed? Although I don't think the average voter has thought about that, but it's but there is a certain set of assumptions behind that. You know, different moral paradigms. You know, for example, sexuality. You know, like the from what I can tell, the more liberal side of the spectrum, they view sexuality in a more companionate, romantic sense. You know, like they think, well, you know, gay relationships are fine because as long as they're romantic and companionate and all that, that's what it's about. Whereas, you know, the other side tends to have a more of a traditionalist view of, well, no, family and marriage and all that is about reproduction and family construction, and not to mention religion and all these other things. So you've got that clash of values, and that's just one example. But you have these kind of almost quasi-religious worldviews that you see coming into conflict, and then they play out when it comes to all of these different issues as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed it does. And, you know, before we move on to the next question, the next super chat, by the way, everyone, the last call is coming soon. So if you have a reasonable, responsible question, comment for Keith or myself, please leave in the live chat. Super chat, we'll get to it, but just please don't hold it all from the end. Thank you in advance. So, you know, I think, Keith, the United States is in a unique situation where people on the left call the other side unpatriotic, people on the right call the other side unpatriotic, and they both have a litany of reasons as to why they're doing this. And it seems to me that America today is not really a nation in a traditional sense. It certainly used to be something that had a sense of cultural unification from sea to shining sea. Essentially, it was the culture of England and, to a lesser extent, Scotland via Northern, what we now call Northern Ireland, and the culture of Britain was sort of diluted to a sense that you could adapt it to pioneer life or life in fairly new cities being like Philadelphia in comparison to something very old like London. But over time, that macro culture, this Anglo-centric macro culture, has been eroded significantly. And today, America is a very tribalized society. And the tribalization does not necessarily break down in the way that a lot of people would imagine, like on the basis of ancestry, even though that's definitely there. But I think there's a sort of new tribalization that's based on lifestyle choices, social affinity groups. John Zogby even wrote a book about, what was it called? Neo-tribes and neo-tribal analytics, which I definitely need to chat about. Oh, here's the title of the book. We Are Many, We Are One, Neo-Tribes and Tribal Analytics. And I'll just do a brief, you know, description of it from Google Books, if the damn thing would ever load. But it says, space and geography, demographics and culture are less relevant. It is no longer about where people are born or where they live. It is more about who they are, how they see themselves, and with whom they choose to identify. This new world is as much about who we choose to, how we choose to identify ourselves, how we define our own priorities, and who we ourselves choose as our cohort, as it is about where we physically work, play, or worship. So that is just, you know, the first sentence of the summary of this book from Zogby, which came out in 2016. And once again, the title is "We Are Many, We Are One: Neo Tribes and Tribal Analytics in 21st Century America." So I think America today really is a nation of various tribes. And the tribes have sort of coalesced into two coalition groups. And one coalition group is very much unsettled by constant social change and is the descendant of the conservative coalition, if you will, in the 1960s social revolution that did not want change. And then you have this other coalition that's descendant of the social movement from the 60s that did want change. And over the years, these two big, you know, tribal coalitions have become farther and farther apart from each other. That's left America not really a functional country in any traditional sense, but rather a nation with many different competing quasi countries within it. And like I said, they all come together in these two big coalitions at election time. So looking at that situation, it does only seem essentially destiny that people would not view the system as being legitimate for whatever reason, because they have less and less of a personal identity which is intertwined with it. They're more intertwined with whatever their tribe is, or, you know, on a broader level, their political coalition. And the system itself then only has legitimacy to either coalition of tribes within them that that they can get out of it whenever their side is in power. So I think that really is sort of like a really macro level view of what's going on here. Before we get to the super chat, Keith, and then I'll make the last call, anything to say about what I just brought up?
No, I agree with that, I think about 100%. I think that a lot of analysis that tries to explain the culture wars or political divisions or whatever often tries to oversimplify things. They make it all just about class, or they make it all just about race, or they make it all just about you know, sexuality and religion or something like that, or so. And it's none of these things, I think, are the real determinants in that. I think it's much more complex than that. You have it's more like what you were saying. There's actually many different tribes that coalesce into these different coalitions. Now, I do think that when you look at what drives the coalitions, there are some common denominators. The Republicans tend to represent cultural groups that represent the macro culture, the once dominant, the kind of the once hegemonic, waspish, you know, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant culture. That's the one common thread in the common and the Republican coalition. The one common thread, I think, in the Democratic coalition is the rainbow culture. You know, it's all about diversity and multiculturalism, and America's a melting pot, and that kind of thing. Although that is changing too. You know, with this last election, like I said, Trump performed better among every demographic other than uneducated white men. So that even that is splintering. In fact, when I follow a lot of the commentary from the left, I see a lot of splits coming from the left over all kinds of things. In fact, I can't even keep up with it. It's like, this is like a soap opera, you know. It's like the you have so many rival factions on the left that all hate each other because somebody somewhere is a fascist or something. It's, the only thing that holds the left together is just their disdain for the traditional WASP culture. That's the one thing they agree on. And in fact, I think that as the culture becomes even more diverse, I have my doubts about how well the left can even hold that coalition together. But yeah, I do think we're subdivided into a lot of tribes, and it's not just racial tribes. It's not just religious tribes. I think political interest groups are tribes unto themselves. Ideologies are a tribe unto themselves, because ideologies reflect how people see the world. And the ideologies that people have are not just based on, you know, their religion, although that may enter into it. It's not just based on their class interest, or it's not just based on their race. You know, those may be factors that shape this to some degree, but there's often more things involved. For instance, if you look at African-Americans, blacks, they are actually the most socially conservative of any Democratic Party voting bloc. They're the most likely to oppose abortion, the most likely to be religious or other churchgoers. But historically, it's just an accidental history that the Democrats are viewed as the civil rights party. So that's why they get the black vote. One thing that was actually very interesting in this last election was a lot of people have focused so much on the presidential election that they didn't look at a lot of state level elections. There were a lot of referendums on ballots in different states about different issues, where I would say, all things considered, the left really had a sweep. Maybe libertarians in some instances, but I know virtually there were dozens of things on different ballots about rolling back drug law enforcement, and virtually every one of those passed, even in very conservative places like, say, Mississippi. Florida, which went for Trump, voted to increase the minimum wage. Mm-hmm. California voted to not roll back some criminal justice reforms that had been implemented by previous referendum. But one thing that was very interesting is that even within this framework, in California, there was an initiative, a pro-affirmative action initiative that was actually voted down in California. Now, this is in California, which is a majority-minority state. Right. There's no demographic majority there. Everybody's a minority in California. It's also a very deep blue state that goes Democrat without question. And it's a one party state internally. And it's one of the most quote unquote liberal states in the United States, obviously. But this affirmative action initiative was voted down. And the reason it was voted down was because the no vote was a mixture of whites, Asians, and Latinos, with the pro-affirmative action vote being primarily blacks and white liberals in the Bay Area and the Los Angeles. Right? So what this is showing is that as the society is becoming more diverse ethnically, we're not necessarily seeing the same breakdown where it's, you know, people of color versus white hegemony. In fact, we're seeing more fragmentation among the ethnic minority groups over some of these kinds of things. You have, for example, Asian Americans saying, "Well, this affirmative action thing doesn't do anything for us." I think we're gonna see more and more of that in the future. And we could look at any number of these tribal issues that we were thinking about. The gay rights, the transgender, the LGBT, certainly that's not going to jibe with a lot of conservative Muslim immigrant communities. That goes without saying. A lot of African Americans are not, enamored of that. And I think also we're going to start to see things from the cultural fringes become more mainstream beyond that. For instance, I know at least one locality now has voted to or has established a policy of formally recognizing polyamory. So it's so de facto legalizing polygamy. That's not really what they've done literally, but it's, you know, it's the same way the gay marriage thing started. It started off as sort of like, well, we'll have a civil union or a formal registered partnership. I think San Francisco was the first place to have something like that, you know, 30 years ago or something.
Boulder, Colorado, I think was.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. Right. But now there's actually one of the northeastern states, Rhode Island or Connecticut or one of them, implemented something like that for polyamory. So de facto legalization of polygamy. And, you know, so I think we're going to start to see more and more, you know, fragmentation along these kinds of cultural lines. You know, this walk away movement is something I find interesting. You have this kind of rainbow conservatism that's developing now. You know, it's I think that's going to be another thing. It's going to be really interesting. In fact, one thing that I've noticed, and some commentators have pointed this out, is when you see these clashes on the street now between all these street level groups, these Proud Boys and Antifa and BLM and some of the others like that, you'll often see minorities on the right wing side. And then if you see a camera angle of you know, a lot of the left wing protesters, they're all white people. You know, it's not just a racial breakdown. It's not just a, you know, a socioeconomic breakdown. It's a people grouping off into all kinds of tribes, you know, of different kinds, you know, that reflects the diversity of the wider society. I mean, you can go on social media, on Facebook, and find, you know, the goth conservatives or something, or transsexuals for Trump or something, you know, it'll be, and also people are assuming more and more, unconventional identities for themselves too. Like, you now have people who actually call themselves transracial, you know, like, well, I may look white, but I've chosen to be black, you know, or vice versa or whatever. And, or then this other kin movement, you know, these people who say that, you know, well, you know, why should we as humans identify only as humans? You know, I may have some animal characteristics. I may have some, you know, part of me is perhaps a bat or a dog or something.
Oh, the other kin, as they call them.
Yeah, the other kin. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I know of no barrier to the mainstreaming of that. You know, I think that, it's, you have a big rivalry that's going on among the feminists between the, what they call the sex positive feminists, which are basically the pro porn and pro prostitution and all of that feminists, versus whatever the other side would be, the neo Puritan feminists or whatever. The neo social purity feminists. So, that's actually a big split. Also, you have the TERFs. You have these, they're called, trans exclusionary radical feminists. So these are like anti-transgender feminists. So, and we could go on and on and on talking about all these different kinds of identity groups and subcultures and stuff that are actually growing in size. And I expect there'll be more and more of them over time, and the political ramifications of that we'll have to see.
Yeah, indeed we will. The walkaway movement is interesting. It definitely did not end, I think, with 2020. It's going to be around for a while, and I think it's sort of like a harbinger, not necessarily the harbinger, just an example of, because this was happening even before walkaway. Walkaway is just a very prominent expression of it. How do I put it? The aspect of a reorientation, if you will, conservatism or non-leftism, which is what I think the Republican Party is heading toward, not even a sort of coherent philosophical conservatism, which you can debate whether or not it ever had in the first place. But it won't be like the Reaganism, three-stool defense, national security, social, and fiscal conservatism any longer. It's going to be just simply opposing the left and whatever the left is now, because it's annoyed a critical mass of people. So I think that's the direction of the GOP and the walkaway movement is a sign of the time. It's a very prominent, you know, light, bright, blinking neon sign of the time. But a sign of the times all the same. And from statics, Trump has 95% approval in the Republican Party. Perdue or Loeffler can't turn out a sack of potatoes without supporting Trump's Stop the Steal. But that's very true. And that's why neither one, I mean, it's part of the reason, I'm sure, why neither one has come out against it. And they're both in favor now of signature verification and recount, which is going on. So it's I don't disagree at all, statics. I think that's a very solid take. Keith, anything to say about what statics brought up?
Yeah, well, Trumpism is the Republican Party now. If Trump, for example, as I was talking about earlier, if he makes a break with Fox News, because they have been, you know, perfect. Most of Fox News have been very happy to, you know, to pronounce Biden the winner of the election. If Trump and his movement walk away from mainstream conservatism altogether, then the Republicans are cooked. I mean, because I don't even know how they could even continue as a party without the Trumpist movement at this point. I mean, they could try to reinvent themselves as sort of a moderate Republican party or this walk away party or something like that. They could, but that's not enough to amass a winning coalition nationwide. You know, it's like they're pretty much enthralled to Trump at this point. Particularly if Trump tries to run again in 2024, I have my doubts about whether that'll happen. I mean, he'll be almost 80 years old at that point. Although, I wouldn't put it past him to try it anyway, but I tend to be skeptical with that. I've said before, we really have three parties now in the United States. We've got the centrist neoliberal party, which has two wings, the Pelosi Democrats and the McConnell Republicans. And they're just about business as usual. They just want to keep the grift coming. And then you've got the Trumpist party, and then you've got the Social Democrats, which are Bernie and AOC and the Squad and all of that. So you've really got three parties, which is kind of like what you find in many other democratic countries. When most democracies, you may have four parties. You know, you'll have a center right, center left, further left, and sort of social democratic, and then a further right. You know, nationalist. You know, like the National Assembly in France or something like that. So that wouldn't be particularly unusual.
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting to see all this developing, and I think it's only going to get more interesting as time goes on. And I will just say that this is finally the last call. If you have a reasonable, responsible question or comment for Keith or myself, please do post it in the live chat as a super chat, and we'll get to it. But this is the last call, so if you have anything that you'd like for us to address that's reasonable and responsible, here's your opportunity to do so. Thank you very much in advance. So, Keith, what do you suppose the future of the United States is, considering that both sides look at the political system as, you know, increasingly illegitimate? Obviously, folks on the left, or the Biden supporters, Never Trumpers, whatever you want to call them, I think that they might see the system now as somehow having saved its legitimacy. But as soon as something goes wrong, something that they don't like, which could come as soon as Trump getting reelected through, the Electoral College or the U.S. House, or maybe it'll be Mitch McConnell stonewalling successfully anything Biden tries to do. But I think as soon as this happens, they're going to be back saying the system's illegitimate, it's all a sham, blah, blah, blah. And then, of course, folks on the right, even if Trump does somehow get a second term, they're going to say, we came this close, the system's illegitimate anyway, we have to, be skeptical of it. So one way or the other, I think you're going to have extreme distrust in the legitimacy of America's governing system, specifically its democratic process, but even goes beyond that. So what do you see the ultimate outcome of this being? Where do you think that this will all wind up eventually?
Well, in terms of in the long run, I think that California is the bellwether of the future of the United States. If you look at what's happening in California, you see that California has become a de facto one-party state. And you see that the tech oligarchy and the media industries that are located in California are essentially the ruling class. And then you see this managerial class that are their allies. And then you see this increasingly diverse poor and working class that's widely separated from the more affluent classes and is extremely diverse ethnically, but within this kind of liberal cultural paradigm. And I think that's what the entire United States, for the most part, is going to look like at some point in the future. The only way I could see that not happening would be if a Republican coalition could emerge that's still large enough that it can consistently gain electoral majorities on a national level. The Republicans have not won an election by popular vote, except for one time since 1988. If you look at the last time the Republicans got a popular majority in an election, it was when George H.W. Bush defeated Mike Dukakis, except for the one time that George W. Bush defeated John Kerry in 2004. And I think what happened there was the unique circumstances of being only a few years after 9/11. Yeah, and Bush was viewed as harder on national security. Whereas at the time, Kerry was viewed as the most liberal person in the Senate. But so I think that was kind of a fluke. You know, other than that one thing that after post 9/11 aftermath, the Republicans have not won the popular vote in 32 years. So it's the Electoral College has saved them on a couple of occasions. And I don't see what could reverse that. I mean, I've thought about this before. I thought, well, okay, if I was a strategist for the Republican Party and my job was to advise the Republican Party how to win the popular vote, I don't know really what I would do. Obviously, what the party leadership wants to do was to just continue this recycled Reaganism. I don't think that's the solution. Mm-hmm. But I do think that they're going to have to at least rhetorically move leftward on some economic questions. I think they're going to have to be more open to kind of a Tucker Carlson-esque, you know, Pat Buchanan-esque type of economic nationalism, or maybe like a Christian democratic type of paradigm. You know, well, it's like we have a duty to care for the less fortunate, you know, because it's a Christian nation after all, or something like that, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, you know, even if it's not sincere, I mean, at least being open to that kind of rhetoric, I think is a shift they'll have to make. But I think that the real issue as far as the future of the red-blue divide is what is going to keep the blue team from getting the upper hand in that ultimately. You know, like instead of having the two sides pitted against each other constantly, it seems to me that the blue team is going to actually get the upper hand just on the basis of sheer numbers at some point. And as the red team constricts, they may, in size and influence, they may become more militant and more hard line in their approach, you know, trying to go down with the fight. You know, you might even see right-wing terrorism and all that kind of stuff. But I don't know how they're going to reverse that in terms of actually being able to win a political majority. Now, they may be able to do it in some regions. I think that probably what is very likely to happen is as the red team and the various tribes that make up the red team continue to shrink in size or continue to lose power politically, they may become more active and more militant, say, at the local level or the state level than in geographical areas where there's still a majority. And that, I think, could really cause some real upheaval. I mean, we saw somewhat a prototype for this with these Second Amendment sanctuary counties. You know, we had here in Virginia, we had the governor was saying he wanted to have some stricter gun laws, and you had all these different rural counties saying, nope, not us. You know, we're just not going to recognize that. And so you could start to see that. You could start to see some of the red zones, you know, whether localities, rural and small town areas, or red states, simply nullifying laws either by the state government or by the federal government that they simply disapprove of. And then there's, of course, there's the big question of, well, would the federal government or whatever, how much force would they want to use to counter that? I think they'd be hesitant to start a full-blown civil war over it or something like that. But I do see things kind of going in that direction. I think the blue tribe is going to get the upper hand on the national level, but then you're going to have these pockets of resistance by the red tribe. But then another wild card and all that is, what about all these smaller tribes? You know, how is that going to shape how this unfolds? You know, like what I was saying earlier about how affirmative action was voted down in California, a deep blue area. When the demography changes on that level, how is that going to affect things? And that's a whole new situation.
You know, it's interesting because the Republican Party certainly does not have a good future in terms of winning the popular vote in presidential elections. I don't even know if that's feasible going forward. It probably isn't. But in the U.S. Senate, when you consider how the population of the country is distributed, the Republicans actually are going to be in a better position going forward because they're going to be dominant in more states that are emptying out their, reading many different sources about this. It's not like a conservative conspiracy theory. This is something generally agreed upon. that a lot of states can be emptying out their more progressive liberal folks to certain, you know, large urban centers already, vote Democratic in other states, and that's going to put the Republicans in a better position going forward in the U.S. Senate. Meanwhile, in the U.S. House, it would be the opposite, because obviously these cities would then get more congressional districts within them, and it would increase the Democratic presence in the U.S. House. So perhaps one could say that gridlock in Congress, at least, looks to be the rule of the day going forward, with some exceptions, depending on the election cycle, of course. But then also in the presidency, the Republicans look to have a very bad future, even with the Electoral College being there to help them. Although they still, as long as they have enough support in the Rust Belt, perhaps do have a fighting chance. I would say they still do have a fighting chance, at least until Texas goes Democratic, which is not as impending, thankfully, as I thought it was. So looking at this last election cycle, I don't think that's really on the horizon within, you know, the next few election cycles, even though the 2030s it might happen, but I definitely not before then, in my opinion. So I think it's a really unique time to be an election season observer looking at all these political trends. I will say here in Florida, it's interesting because people have been saying for decades that it would eventually go Democratic because of people moving here. But what the Republican Party's done is it's entrenched itself and it's become so used to winning close elections that it now has a statewide machine that even though there's more registered Democrats than Republicans, even though the gap is narrowing, the Republicans are getting more voters, the Republicans here have total control over the state Supreme Court, both House and legislature, obviously the governorship, and they've managed to have one-party rule basically no less fierce than what you find in California, even though the margin of victory for the state Republicans is much closer. And after the next round of redistricting, it's probably going to be a total, you know, the Republicans right now hold lopsided majorities in the state legislature, but it's going to be even more lopsided. So I think a lot of Republicans will have to adapt to finding ways of maintaining power, obviously within the bounds of the law, and holding on to that power as much as the law allows. You can see how that's been done in Florida, but I think you'll have to be emulated in other states like Georgia, which is now a swing state, whether Trump winds up winning or not, still a swing state, but there is a serious Democratic constituency there that's growing. And so a lot of Republicans are going to have to get used to not being safe anymore in their state going for the GOP, and they're going to have to become more wise, shall I say, to competitive election strategies. But that doesn't change the fact that in terms of the national popular vote, it's definitely something which is pro-democratic, if you will. And I don't think the Republicans have any serious prospect of winning the popular vote going forward, even though they might still eke out victories in the Electoral College from time to time. But who knows how long that'll last for. So there is something in the live chat for us, and we'll get to it. But Keith, anything to say about anything I just brought up?
I don't really disagree with any of that from a purely electoral and partisan perspective. Although I do, I would add to that two things. First, from the when we look at the electoral system, I do think that at some point, I strongly suspect at least, that the Democrats will move to try to expand the size of the Supreme Court, pack the Supreme Court. I think at some point they will try to expand the size of the Senate by creating more states, and also expanding the number of House seats by creating more districts and creating more federal judicial districts. So basically it makes it easier to judge shop, what in legal professions called judge shopping. And also expanding voting rights in a way that it's going to be favorable to their side. I do see all that on the horizon. The first time the Democrats get a confident electoral majority, the first time they have a Democratic president and a majority in the House and the Senate and a majority of the states, or at least a majority of the states that have the big electoral presence, I think they're probably going to start moving to implement some of those kinds of things because they see that as, you know, that's the holy grail from their perspective. But even more significant, though, than electoral and partisan maneuvering is culture. I tend to look at it like the culture shapes the political outcomes to a large degree. And I see that one thing is going to happen is if the Republicans continue to attract this kind of walk-away crowd, that's actually going to have the effect of liberalizing Republicanism. I mean, you're being a Republican is going to be being yesterday's Democrat. Because it's basically just going to be, you know, this kind of rainbow conservatism of liberals who don't like the hard left is what it's going to amount to. Another thing you see is the exodus from the states that have moved further left. Like you see a lot of exodus from New York. You see a lot of exodus from California and Oregon and some of those places. And often these are more middle class people who don't like taxes and that kind of stuff. But they're still going to bring this kind of moderately left viewpoint with them, you know, to wherever they yeah. migrate to. So let's say you have a lot of people migrating from, you know, California to Arizona and Texas and Idaho or somewhere like that. But that doesn't mean they're going to become devout Republicans overnight. It just means they're going to be more centrist Democrats, you know, who are against the hard left Democrats or something like that. But that's one thing. So you're going to see the liberalization of so-called conservatism happening on a lot of different levels, and in a way that politically starts shifting the culture of a lot of the individual states. So I think what matters in the long run is really where is the culture going right. when it comes to these things, more so than what the actual parties are going to be doing. You know, like Paul Gottfried always jokes that in the future, you know, the Republicans are going to be saying that gay marriage is a great conservative innovation. You know, it's there are in fact self-identified conservatives who say that. I don't see a return to cultural conservatism in some general sense. You know, like I know we have some groups that, so, you know, some of the more socially conservative political groups, their goal is they want to repeal the Cultural Revolution of the 60s and 70s and all of that. And I just don't see that happening. I think we're going to move a lot further leftward. You know, like one thing I always tell my sociology students is that in their lifetime, they're probably going to see a movement in the United States to legalize polygamy. Mm-hmm. And I always point to the factors that will lead into that. One is the polyamory movement. One is the fact is immigration. We're going to have immigration from cultures where polygamy is allowed or even practiced. You're going to have the growth of the proliferation of religions that accept this. For example, the Wicca religion accepts polygamy. So I suspect that's going to be. I think sex worker rights, like prostitutes and all that. I think that's going to be the new trans rights or something in the future. It doesn't mean there's not going to be pushbacks against that. And in fact, I think you may even see a more militant type of right wing perspective developing. Say for example, as whites become a smaller population group, you may see a surge of white nationalism, at least on the margins. And then there's the gun rights, and then there's the religious conservatism, mm-hmm. and then there's pro-life. So it's not like that's not going to go away, and it may even become more militant over time. But I do see this cultural leftward drift happening, and I don't see that being reversed.
Yeah, I think the Republican Party sort of will go and like the walk away, anti-left, not so much pro, you know, movement or ideological conservative direction, but will have these sort of elements that are very hard line, as you described. And much as they'll hate the GOP because they don't think it's pure enough, they'll still wind up voting for it anyway because the Democrats are that much worse.
Right, right. Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's quite entirely possible in the future that you would have a Republican Party candidate who is someone on the equivalent of Dave Rubin.
Oh, sure, without question.
A gay married atheist, you know, who's like the front man of conservatism, you know, mm-hmm. and then the hardline, the redneck Republicans are going to vote for him because, hey, at least he's not going to take our guns away.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah, I absolutely see that trajectory playing out. And I think Trump is probably the guy who blazed the trail for it in a way that very few people would imagine. But obviously, Keith and I are one might say, wise to the trajectory. Now, I think this is the last question from One Man's Chorus. Keith, is it rational for BLM to riot since the risks are minimal? They rarely get arrested. Charges are dropped. Few people are killed, and the rewards are plentiful, looting stores, donations to BLM Global Alliance.
So the question is it rational for them?
For them to riot, correct.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, I don't know why it wouldn't be. I mean, rioting can be a tactic that is used effectively in many instances. In fact, during the heyday of the civil rights movement during the latter part of the civil rights movement of the 60s, when it started moving in the more black power direction, the more militant direction, you would actually see that. You would actually see Black power leaders saying, well, you know, it could be a long, hot summer. That was one of the terms they used to use, basically saying, well, you know, you either give us what we want or we'll, you know, there may be some consequences like rioting and that kind of thing. So, yeah, I mean, now the Black Lives Matter movement, I think, is actually more diverse than a lot of people make it out to be. I've come across all kinds of things under the banner of Black Lives Matter, ranging from just really way out leftist stuff to basically people who are training to be cops because they want to, you know, reform the system from the inside or something like that. You know, and then you have a lot of people that just use the slogan or put up a banner that says Black Lives Matter that aren't part of any kind of organization that calling themselves that is just a slogan. But there are organizations that do call themselves Black Lives Matter. In fact, I think there are multiple groups like that.
Yeah, there are.
Also, when it comes to rioting and looting and stuff like that, there have been all kinds of people involved in that. I know Joseph and I did another program where we were talking about that. But one thing I think is interesting is that from what I could tell, there were multiple factions involved in the riots that happened over the summer. BLM was one, but then the far left was one. There were some sectors of the far right. You had a lot of people involved in that that just seemed to be the equivalent of a sports riot or, you know, the kind of rioting you'd see at a soccer game in Latin America. And then you also had a lot of, I guess, what you would call opportunistic rioting. I mean, it was basically just crime. You know, it's basically just like, well, okay, now's the opportunity. The police are distracted. Let's go, you know, steal some video games or whatever. There's a ton of that kind of stuff. I think the most interesting about it was you actually had what seemed to me to be an armed insurgency by what is genuinely the lumpen proletarian class, which is like the very bottom layer of socioeconomic level. I saw that in my area. I saw people out there doing organized looting of strip malls. And these were not left-wing protesters. Most of these were white people. This seemed to me to be an organized, this is like the peasants, you know, looting the master's warehouse in feudal societies or something.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah, the Black Lives Matter thing is very multifaceted. And then you have people who latch onto it simply for their own purposes, as you just described. And it's a fascinating matter, really. It is, as much as I think Black Lives Matter has been a destructive force in American society, it certainly is nothing that you could oversimplify or, you know, use as sort of, you know, casual anecdote. Maybe that's the best way of putting it. But how do you even describe it? It's something that's political, it's something that's cultural, it's something that has to do with history. It's this really this thing that's very potent, very powerful, but at the same time, it's so hard to describe because it has so many different aspects that are quite different from each other.
Yeah, I think that the slogan itself is very powerful, Black Lives Matter, because on the surface, it's like, okay, well, yeah, all right. Most people aren't going to disagree with that.
Exactly.
But then you have some people that say, well, what about all lives? And then the counter to that is, but that's racist, because then you're trying to deflect attention from the Black issue. So it's really the perfect slogan for a movement that's really trying to gain this kind of perceived moral high ground, which is a big part of fourth generation warfare. You know, that's another angle we could explore. But I know when that was really starting to erupt, I would see people on social media who are not political people, who never post anything political, but then they were posting their Black Lives Matter, you know, their emblem or slogan or say their names or whatever, you know. And a lot of that just struck me as, well, it got to be part of the in crowd. You know, it's like wearing with the same tennis shoes everybody else is wearing or something like that. Because a lot of these are people that I know when that's how they think. So I know that's where they were coming from. But
yeah, it's something else. It really is. And we'll see where it goes. I think after a while it'll get old, as essentially all social phenomena do. But how long that'll be and then what will come about from Black Lives Matter, that's another question entirely. Well, Keith, this has been an outstanding conversation. Thank you very much for stopping by tonight.
Yes, glad to be here. Always a good visit here.
It's always great conversations we have. And I said this last time, but Paul has to be on for the next one because there's really just a lot to go over. And obviously he brings much enrichment to any one of these discussions.
I agree. Yeah.
And well, I guess I'll just say thank you for tuning in, everyone, wherever you just watched, whether you participated in the live chat, in the super chat. I raise my now empty styrofoam mug to you. Thank you just for being here. And yeah, once again, thanks for tuning in, everyone. See you next time. Before we go, though, if you like this episode and want to support the show, please consider donating to it by clicking on the PayPal link in the description below. Paul and I appreciate your generosity very much. Cheers, all. We'll be right back.